Thinking of the song that we just sang reminded me of another announcement to give you here, just for the sake of knowing it, is that on Father's Day, so on whatever it is, third Sunday in June, and we're going to have a baptism here. And so if there are people who are interested in that, please come and speak to me or to Andreas, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Something that we always look forward to seeing here when people listen to what God says and follow him in that step of obedience and baptism. And so I'd like to invite you to consider that. And if it's something that you would like to do, please let us know. So we're going to start with a little social studies here as we begin. Just to kind of cast your minds back way to when you used to do that kind of thing, right? So I was thinking, as I was preparing here for this morning, about a story that happened back in the year 391 AD, so this is a few years ago, back in the late 4th century, the time of the waning years, the kind of the fading out of the Roman Empire. After being 700 or 800 years kind of on top of the world, then all of a sudden it was starting to crumble, the Roman Empire. First assaulted and sacked by the Gauls in 410 AD, if you didn't know that number. This is just 15 or 20 years before, and so past the end of Rome's glory, and when they're starting to be not so good. And has often been observed and said, mighty nations like that generally fall apart from within, not with somebody from the outside coming and taking it over, though that was kind of what finished them off. But that was the case with Rome. Backstabbing, depravity, immorality became the order of the day. In fact, I discovered this, that of the 28 emperors the last 200 years of Rome's history, 27 of them were assassinated. It's not a very good picture as to what was happening at the end of Rome's history, right? And as for depravity and immorality and that kind of thing, well, we hear stories of the Roman orgies and of people like Emperor Caligula who purportedly slept with his horse, and on and on. I mean, all these kind of things. And so this kingdom was not in good shape. And another of the evidences of this was the Battle of the Gladiators, and that's what I wanted to talk about here for a few minutes, where two men or more would come into the Colosseum complete with their lance and their sword and their battle axe and whatever else they had, and they would come and face the dignitaries who were up at the front and say, the emperor would be there, and they'd say, "Hail Caesar, we die to the glory of Caesar." And then in front of 80,000 or so paying customers, they would fight, not just for victory, but until one of them was dead. Sort of like a hockey game nowadays, but a little bit worse. Did I just go to... Oh, there we are. We're back. Anyways, a disgusting spectacle of depravity and an indication of where the empire really was at. But God continues to work regardless of what the world is like, in fact, because of what the world is like, right? And so there was a young monk by the name of Telemachus who earlier felt called of God to go to Rome and to reach the citizenry there. The year was 391 A.D., Rome wasn't, as I said, like it had been. It was down to like 500,000 people. There had been 1 million people living in Rome before. But anyways, he was in Rome. And as he walked the streets, and thinking of what it was that God would have him do there, he found a great mass of people headed in one direction. And so he kind of got caught up in this and went along with them to where they were going to see what it was. And so they were headed to the Colosseum, which was Rome's kind of entertainment center, where people would go to watch the chariot races, or they had even naval battles, where they'd fill the Colosseum with water and they'd have these naval battles. They would do all kinds of stuff. But the most popular show was that of the gladiators. And that's what was happening the day that Telemachus was there. So he came in with the crowds, probably ending somewhere up in the nosebleed section, right? And watched the gladiators battle for not very long before he stood up and he yelled, "In the name of Christ, stop!" And everybody kind of ignored him, except for probably the people beside him, who said, "Shut up, you're destroying the show here." But anyways, he started to go down to the Colosseum, and he's yelling this the whole way down. "In the name of Christ, stop!" And he keeps going and going. And climbed over the railing and came right up to the gladiators and proclaimed again, in the name of Christ, stop. Now, at this point, in the books that I read, history is a little unclear whether he was run through with a sword or whether he was stoned. But anyways, he was killed that day in the Colosseum, another martyr for the cause of Christ, though in a different manner than other ones who had been fed to the lions in the very same place, right? But that day, it wasn't long after that that the crowds, in disgust from what they had just seen happen, started to leave. And they left, and they left, and the place emptied out. And that was the last day that they had battles of the gladiators in the Colosseum, which was kind of intriguing that this that it happened for years. Other things still happened at the Colosseum, you know, for years to come, but they didn't have a gladiator battle there anymore. Because here was a man who was willing to stand up. Even though it meant standing alone, and even though it might mean losing his life, which it did in the end, this man made a difference. And so I was thinking about him. And he's not the only one, though, right? Over the centuries, millions of men and women have made a difference because they were willing to stand up and to be a lone voice in the midst of so much that was coming against them. Turn to Hebrews 11, please. I started last week a kind of a little brief series here looking at some of these the people that we look at and find in Hebrews 11. Last week we looked at Noah, thinking about how his righteousness and his blamelessness and his obedience and his faith and his walk with God helped him do what God called him to do. Hebrews 11, and I want to read at verse 32, just one paragraph here. And it says there, Hebrews 11, 32, what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging. Still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were people who made a difference, because they were willing to stand up and speak for the one who can make a difference in everyone's lives. And we all know people, maybe not like these ones here that we read about, but people who have made a huge difference in the lives of so many people. I think even of the movie we're watching here tonight about Molly, you know, someone who has made a difference in the lives of all kinds of people because they were willing to stand up. Well, we're going to look at another story of one of these people. Look at verse 30 and 31. Just before where we read, and it says, by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. Excuse me. So Rahab, we're going to think about Rahab today. A different kind of character, one who you don't, generally speaking, hear somebody speaking on a Sunday morning about Rahab and extolling her virtues. In fact, you know, I was trying to remember if I ever heard anybody speak about Rahab. But anyways, you're going to hear that today. We're going to think about Rahab. So turn to Joshua chapter 2, please. Because in Hebrews 11, we just have that those two verses that talk about her. But we find her story back in Joshua. So Joshua chapter 2. I'm not going to read it all to you, but I'll kind of tell some of it to you because it's quite a long story. But it has everything, you know, if you would cast your minds and remember the story, and if not, just kind of see what you can catch from what I say. Everything you need to make a good James Bond movie. I was thinking about it as I was looking at it, at the story here. There's the military conflict. You know, I mean, it's not democracy versus communism, which is all the Bond movies, right? But anyways, that's kind of passe. But there's spies, and there's adventure, there's suspense, there's even a chase scene, okay? And there's a beautiful woman. Okay, so everything you'd expect to find in a good James Bond movie. So they should base one on this, right? Anyways, Joshua, who the book is named after, is the field general in this military conflict. I'm a seasoned veteran who learned the ropes from his predecessor, Moses. But center stage is never really his. The biblical writers take great pains to show that God is the one who's leading the nation at this time. And as the book opens, the Israelites are camped across the Jordan River from Canaan, so on what we call the East Bank nowadays. And the Israelites had been given great assurance from God in Joshua 1 and verse 5. We read there, "No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life." Can you imagine having somebody say that to you? And especially if it's the God of the universe saying it to you, "No one will be able to stand up to you against you all the days of your life." That's pretty encouraging, you know, that you're doing the right thing if God comes to say that to you. Anyways, to enter in back into the kind of the Bond intrigue, before mapping out his battle plan, Joshua decides to spend a couple of his double knot spies in, right? And exactly as you would expect. And the two spies meet a lady, again, as you would expect in a good James Bond movie. But more precisely, she's a prostitute, it tells us here. In our Sunday school past, we came to know her as Rahab the Harlot, almost like that was her last name. That's when you're little, you don't know what that word means, and your Sunday school teacher said it so that you didn't really understand the whole story. But anyways, we kind of know her as Rahab the Harlot. In Josephus, the historian's record, her place is referred to as an inn, and she as an innkeeper, sort of, you know, bed and breakfast, perhaps with a little bit extra. The Bible doesn't tell us particularly why they chose this place. It simply says that they stayed there. And it's certainly reasonable to assume that the visit was purely in the line of duty, and that her place was, because her place was built across the walls of Jericho, from the outer wall to the inner wall, and it was right there on the top. And so it was a handy place to get in and to get out quickly and to look around and see what they could discover. So the king of Jericho, it tells us here in Joshua 2, hears about these people. They probably, you know, thought they were good spies and nobody was going to know. But he hears about them, and he sends a posse off to get them, to bring them in for questioning, right, as you could well expect. So they come to Rahab's house, and knowing full well the spies were up on the roof, hiding underneath some flax or whatever it was, Rahab said to the posse, essentially, "Yeah, I've seen them, but they just left. I'm sure you can catch them, though." And so with all the wisdom of Barney Fife, instead of 007 kind of people, the posse went off in hot pursuit without so much as even looking through the house to see if they were there. Okay, so Rahab went up to the men, saying to them, "I know where you're coming from, and I know what's going to happen to us, because I know that your God is God," is what she says to them. And people here are terrified. "When you defeat these people, will you save me?" So they signed the Scarlet Thread Treaty, right? And the spies went back to Joshua. So a few days later, the devastating news came to Jericho that the Hebrews had crossed the Jordan. Despite it being a flood stage, the gates were shut. No one came in, no one went out. And then all of a sudden, the Israelite army was there. And these people, they were afraid for their lives because they had heard of the things that had happened so far. Now, you've heard sung many times, you know, Joshua, the Battle of Jericho, right? But instead of a full-scale attack on the walls, the Israelites just walked around the city once a day for 6 days, right? And on the seventh day, they walked around 6 times. And you can imagine, I was thinking of the VeggieTales version of this story, right? Where the people are, some of you will remember that, it's the peas, right? They're up on the wall, and they're just laughing at these people and making fun of them. Like, what are you doing? What kind of battle plan is this? You're going to walk around the city and defeat us? And humanly speaking, it doesn't make much sense, right? You don't defeat a wall or defeat a city by walking around it, right? So I'm sure that they were making fun of them, spilling Slurpees on them and all the rest, right? That's the VeggieTales one. Okay. Even come the last day, it says they walked around the city seven times. Now, Jericho wasn't a huge city. It was strategic where it was at, but it was probably only a mile or the most 2 miles around the city. So it was smaller than Westlock, but a little more closer together. They walked around and took a couple hours to do that, I'm sure. They all yelled, you know, made the story, and the walls fell down. Except for, and archaeologists have discovered this, you know, one portion of the wall that stayed standing up, you know, deep down in one of the tells at Jericho. You know, they see this wall, that there's all this rubble, and there's this one part where the wall is still standing, likely exactly where Rahab's house was. We have this story of Rahab. We don't find her really mentioned much else anywhere in the Bible, except for in Hebrews 11, and she's mentioned in Matthew chapter 1, interestingly, in the genealogy of Jesus, which is kind of cool that she was King David's like great something grandmother. So we find this story about Rahab. And so I was thinking about it, you know, and thinking, so what can we learn from this person? What can we learn from Rahab, a lady who certainly in where she lived at that time, she wasn't somebody of much repute, rather of ill repute, right? And with so many stories in the Bible, we see an amazing thing in the way that God works, and that he does depend on us. And this was the first thing that I was thinking about. After all, who can stop an army led by a God who brought the Pharaoh of Egypt to his knees and made a highway at the bottom of the Red Sea, led his people with a cloud in the day and fire at night through the wilderness? How could anybody stop him? Well, they couldn't, obviously. But what if Rahab had squealed? What if she had said something? You know, you could think, well, maybe it could have. But God uses ordinary, everyday people like us to accomplish what he is hoping to accomplish. So what was it about Rahab that made her a candidate for God to use? Because normally she's not the kind of person you think that God would be using. Someone with a name like Rahab the harlot. But yet he did, right? God did use her. And there are a couple of things that I want to look at from her life that if they are part of our life, God will use us as well. So back in Hebrews 11, it said, by faith, Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed. So by faith, Rahab had faith in God. Here in Joshua 2:11, and I mentioned this earlier, and this is in the middle of her speaking, and she says, when we heard of it, of their previous conquerings of different places, when we heard of it, our hearts melted and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. Here's someone who knows who God is, who knows who the ultimate God is. And it says, by faith, Rahab did what she did. It's only in our modern enlightened society that people say that there is no God. In the days of Joshua, everybody recognized that there was a God. We live in a world now where they think, oh, that's kind of passé. You know, like God doesn't really exist. You know, I read an old story, kind of like a family of mice who lived all their lives in a large piano. Okay, hopefully there aren't any in this one. To them, in their little piano world came the beauty of music. Right, filling all the dark places with sound and with harmony. And at first the mice were impressed by it, and they drew comfort and wonder from the thought that out there, someone with a capital S was making this music. And isn't that beautiful? Though invisible to them, yet close to them. And so they loved to think of the great player who they couldn't see. Then one day a daring mouse, let's call him, you know, Darwin or something like that, climbed up part of the piano and returned very thoughtful. He found out how music was made, right? He said, wires were the secret, tightly stretched wires of graduated lengths that trembled and vibrated, and this is what made music. And they had to revise their old beliefs about the great player who was playing the piano. And none but the most conservative would any longer believe in him. Later, another explorer carried it even further, and he said, hammers are the secret. They hit those wires, and that's what makes the sound. And there was a more complicated theory, but it went to show that we live in a purely mechanical and mathematical world, right? And the unseen player can only be thought of as a myth. But the piano continued to play. And so we live in a world where God continues to work, and yet people dismiss him and say that there isn't such a thing, and it can't be. There's no way that that's the case. But we see that Rahab understood that there was a God. And even more, she understood that the God of the Israelites was the God. And so had faith in him. In Hebrews 13 and 8, so just a chapter later, it's a familiar verse that says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Right? So the God of the Israelites, the God of Rahab, is the same one who we put faith in, our faith in today. But we get to see the other side of the picture that Rahab didn't. Because as we look back, we put our faith in the finished work of Christ on the cross. For Rahab, she could only see that God was sovereign and in control. But we can see that and so much more because of what Christ has done for us. But Rahab didn't just believe in a higher power, you know, like many in our world would say, that's all you need to believe in. No, she believed in the one true God of Israel, a God who you can have a personal relationship with. And so we see that about Rahab. Her faith was personal. Secondly, and it's really kind of just taking the other one a little bit further, from the verse in Hebrews 11, it says, by faith, Rahab, because she welcomed the spies. And then it goes on from there. But it leads to a second point about Rahab, though in a sense, really, it's just a kind of a better definition of the first. It wasn't just, yep, the God of the Israelites is God for sure, and left it at that, because it tells us in James 2 and 19 that even the demons believe that, right? And so that wasn't enough. In most of the rest of the book of James, he's trying to get the point across that we can see here from Hebrews 11 and 31, that faith is accompanied by works. If it's not, it's dead. Faith is active. And so Rahab's faith was active. She believed in God, and she did something about it. I came across a story the other day about, this was in 1958, when America's first commercial jet air service began with the flight of the Boeing 707, the first flight of that. And a month after that flight, there was a traveler on a good old, you know, piston engine propeller driven DC-6 aircraft. And he was sitting beside a man who he discovered was an engineer for Boeing who had worked on these jet engines. And so he was talking to him about it, you know, and he's quite intrigued by all of this stuff, right? About these new jet aircraft and all of their testing and the reliable results that Boeing had, and said, we can go forward with this, and then they did. And eventually the traveler asked the engineer if he had the opportunity yet to fly on one of these jets. And he said, I think I'll wait till it's been in service for quite a while yet. You know, so here was someone who he made this thing himself, but he didn't have faith that it was going to work. And so he didn't take these steps. Rahab was somebody who had faith and then did something about it. And faith has to not just be in a personal God, but faith has to be active. We have to do something about it. It needs to be something that you believe it and you take a step. You know, as I was thinking about that last night, I was thinking of the scene I always think of and have shared her for sure, from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Okay, and if you've probably seen it at some point, but the story is, if you don't know, is Indiana Jones is this archaeologist who's looking for the chalice of Christ, okay, like the cup that he drank out of at the Last Supper. So he's following this book of clues, I forget what it's called. And anyways, in that he comes to this place where he comes to the very edge of a precipice, okay, he comes kind of through a mountain to this, through this tunnel, and he comes to this place, and he comes out, and something falls over just like that. No, that would not have been good. if he tripped and fell. But anyways, he comes to the edge of this precipice, right? And on the far side, about as far away as the back of the thing there, there's a doorway. And this is where he's trying to get into this doorway. And so he said, how am I going to get there? You know, because it's a couple hundred feet straight down, and this is, you know, 50 or more feet away. So he has to get to this precipice, or to the other side. And then he reads in, you know, in his book again, and it says, just take a step of faith. Take a step of faith. And meanwhile, I mean, if you know the rest of the story, his father's dying back there, and he needs to get water from the chalice to save him. But anyways, so he closes his eyes and goes and takes a step. And as he takes a step, his foot lands on something. And then the camera kind of pans around to the side, and you see that there's a bridge there that goes right across, a little narrow bridge right to the other side that you couldn't see because the surface, the deck of the bridge, was exactly the same as what the wall looked like on the other side. But he just had to take that step of faith. He had to do something. And it's the same with us in our Christianity. We have to do something. We can't just have this faith and say, I have this faith in this great God who did all these things, and then we don't do anything about it, because then James tells us, your faith is dead. There isn't anything there. So we have to do something about it. So our faith needs to be personal. It needs to be active. The next thing that I have here is we see in Rahab that she was very courageous in her faith. And we need to have courage in our faith. Standing up to the king. I mean, in those days, the king was an autocrat, right? And what he said went, and if you didn't do it, off with your head. Right? That's the way that it was in those kind of days. And yet, she was someone who was willing to stand up to that. She had the courage to do that. The way that she goes about it is maybe questionable, right? She doesn't tell the whole truth to these guys, right? But, you know, I was thinking it's the same as the parable of the shrewd manager that Jesus tells. The point isn't about his dishonesty, but about his shrewdness. And the point here isn't about her dishonesty, but about her courage. We have to have courage in our faith, like Telemachus, you know, for instance, you know, or so many of these other people that we read about in Hebrews chapter 11. But if you want to come more recent, I was thinking again yesterday of a story that you may remember. This is like 10 or 12 years ago. Do you remember Viktor Yushchenko? Maybe not. When I tell you the story, you might remember him. Anyways, he was a man who was running for the president of the Ukraine in the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, something like that. The ruling party didn't want him to come in, and so they poisoned him. Do you remember this story? And so you saw pictures of him, you know, saw this on the net, a picture of him, and then the next day, and he and his daughter had both been poisoned, but he survived and got through that. But it's not his courage that I'm thinking of so much, but on election day, because they had an election and it was declared null and void, they had another election because he had won the first one and the ruling party didn't want that to be the case, so that's why the election didn't count. So then they had another election and he was winning again. But I mean, nobody knew that or whatever, but they knew that. And so there was a television announcement, and it said, we announced that the challenger Yushchenko has been defeated. And so they announced this thing. But down in the bottom corner of the television screen, there was some closed captioning happening, you know, where somebody is signing for the sake of those who are deaf and can't read it. And the lady who was doing that, who was doing the signing, here's what she said. Deaf citizens of the Ukraine, they are lying. I'm ashamed to translate those lies. Yushchenko is the president. And what came out of that, and you might remember this if you are a student of social studies, is something that they called the Orange Revolution. And the nation got, because of the deaf people who were paying attention, they brought this to other people, and the ruling party was kicked out, and Yushchenko became president because of the courage of this one lady who was willing to, you know, all of the party officials are there and making this announcement, and she's there going, no, that's not true, you know. Great courage, you know, for her to be able to do that. And that's the kind of courage that we see that Rahab had in this case. You know, because for sure, for her, would have been, if she had been caught in this before the whole rest of the city, which would have happened, but then the whole rest of the city died instead. She would have paid dearly for it. But she had that courage. And that's the kind of courage that God calls us to have. The kind of courage that Stephen had when he was stoned, you know, that we read about it in Acts, or the heroes of faith that we read about here in Hebrews 11, or of Rahab. So we need to be courageous in our faith. The last thing that I wanted to share is that she also had common sense. She used her common sense to do things like hide the men and bargain with them, shows that to us. God doesn't expect us in our Christianity to take leave of our senses, right? Christianity is something that is. It's very sensible. And he wants us to continue to use our God-given common sense in our Christianity. Look at John chapter 7, just one verse there. And this is a story from the life of Jesus. In John 7 and verse 1, it says, after this, Jesus went around in Galilee, purposely staying away from Judea because the Jews there were waiting to take his life. And I'm just thinking of that one verse, you know. Here, Jesus was just using common sense because he says, and even it's later on in the chapter, right, in verse 6, he says, Jesus told them, the right time for me has not yet come. For you, any time is right. But he knew, my time is not come. And if I go this way, they're going to grab me and kill me, and the time isn't ready yet. So Jesus used common sense. And so we as well need to use common sense in our faith. That doesn't mean that we don't rely on God, but we use common sense at the same time. So what did Rahab have that made it so that she could and did make a difference? Well, we see that she had a true faith in the living God. Personal faith in a personal God. Her faith was active. She did something about this faith. And she was sensible and she was courageous. Now, if we want to make the kind of difference that she made, we can. We just have to have a personal, active, sensible, courageous faith. And we have that. We'll see that we as well, like Telemachus, like all these other people in Hebrews 11, we can make a difference if that is what our faith is like. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we do thank you for the story of someone like Rahab. We thank you for the truth that even though she is someone who we might think in our own prejudices, how could you possibly use her? You did. Because of her faith that was personal and active and sensible and courageous. And so, Father, we know in many respects that we aren't any better than her. How can you use any of us? But you can. But we have to have a personal and an active and a courageous and a sensible faith. And when we do, you will use us. So I pray that as we go from here this morning, you would help that be reality. And that those around us will see that you are our God. We thank you again, and we pray in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, Jared, you have something for us.